Hi, I'm Anne Strangeamps, and I want to take you back to one of the most famous prison riots in American history.
We are men. We are not beasts, and we do not intend to be driven or beaten as such. What has happened here but the sound before the fury of those who are oppressed?
New York's Attica State Prison. 45 years ago, inmates there revolted, taking the facility and 40 staff members hostage. By the end of the four-day standoff, at least 40 people were dead.
Good evening. The four-day insurrection at New York's Attica State Prison came to a tragic end this morning. Negotiations gave way to force, making this the bloodiest prison incident the country has seen in four decades.
This was a long time ago, but the memory of Attica lives on. Today, on To the Best of Our Knowledge, we're asking a simple question. How do you create a more humane prison? And we're starting with Attica.
This is a story told about people who had no power, who were at the mercy of their captors, and who nevertheless fought for human dignity.
Heather Ann Thompson is a historian and author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning account of the Attica Uprising called Blood in the Water. It took her 13 years to research, combing through thousands of public archives and court documents. And what she found is evidence of police negligence and torture during the prison's retaking and of a government cover-up. She tells Steve Paulson that a lot of what we think we know about Attica isn't true, including the image of marauding rioters.
Exactly. I think the prisoners very clearly understood that the world was watching and that this was an opportunity to finally shine some light behind prison walls. So they, each cell block, elected a representative to speak for them. Those people, in turn, organized a medical tent. They organized a food tent. They made sure that everyone was out in the open because they felt that that would be safer. And previous factions in the prison put aside a lot of their differences and said, look, we need to come up with a coherent list of demands. Perhaps the most important thing they did, though, was that they asked for a body of observers to come to Attica to essentially oversee these negotiations with the state and to make sure that the state negotiated in good faith.
Wait, so you're saying that during the this whole period where the prisoners were in charge, there were actually negotiators from the state watching the process?
Absolutely. They had a list of folks they wanted to come in, and some of them were quite, you know, notable folks. And so there were cameras rolling, and it was a remarkable rebellion that was broadcast nationally and internationally.
So this was going on for 4 days. I mean, these negotiations, the prisoners were making their demands. But then
yes.
New York State Police troopers ultimately stormed the prison, retook it, and you write about this in gripping detail. What happened on this day, September 13th, 1971, when state troopers retook the prison?
Well, what's really important about September 13th is that it was a day that all of the observers and even the hostages in D Yard had begged the state of New York not to undertake, because they could see what the prisoners couldn't. They could see outside of the prison that battalion of troopers, state troopers in New York, had sent men to Attica who had been milling around outside of the prison walls now for 4 days with no sleep, with rumors running rampant of inmate atrocities, and passing out weapons indiscriminately. No one was writing down serial numbers. People were bringing their own personal hunting rifles and personal shotguns and personal weapons to the prison. And they knew that if they unleashed this force in the prison, it was going to be deadly. And sure enough, it was. The book for me was – this was the hardest part to write, because how do words fully capture what it meant that in 15 minutes – thousands and thousands of bullets are shot and shotgun pellets are sprayed in this relatively small enclosure where hostages and prisoners alike are already incapacitated because the state had dropped this deadly gas over the prison minutes before.
So you're saying basically everyone was out in the yard. I mean, both the,
yes,
the prisoners plus the hostages, and the whole place was stormed, and the troopers came in and started shooting.
Yes, troopers and also corrections officers who had shown up from all over the state with their personal weapons. And within 15 minutes, of course, they had shot and killed 39 men, prisoners and hostages, and had shot 128 people in total, some of whom had, you know, 6 and 7 bullet wounds. So it was carnage. And frankly, they had control of the prison within probably seconds of going in because the gas had already incapacitated everybody.
There's an official story that came out of the prison uprising. I mean, the story told by the government that that these prisoners were brutal savages. I mean, there were reports of prisoners slashing hostages' throats. In one instance, a hostage was said to have been castrated. Did that happen?
No. The stories of these atrocities were spreading like wildfire. But it's important to understand why. Within minutes of this retaking, I think it's very clear to state officials that it's a disaster, that they have unleashed something that they can't control, and that many, and most importantly to them, hostages had been shot. And so the PR guy from Corrections goes out and tells the world that something altogether different had happened. He says that the prisoners had slashed the throats of the hostages, that the prisoners had actually killed the hostages, and worse, that they had committed atrocities on these hostages, including castrating one of them. That lie made the front page of the New York Times, the LA Times, but most significantly, it went out over the AP, which meant that it was in every small town headline in America. And it was all untrue.
What happened to the surviving prisoners after the prison was retaken?
The retaking, as brutal as it was just a prelude to really what at the time was termed an orgy of violence. For really the next days and weeks and months, these prisoners were beaten and abused. In the minutes after the retaking, as these prisoners, some of whom, again, let me stress, have bullet wounds or shotgun pellets embedded in their bodies, are forced to strip and to crawl over the, you know, shards of glass which are all over the yard. And they are beaten with nightsticks. They are kicked. Their teeth are smashed from their mouths. Their eyeglasses are smashed. They are thrown into cells naked with no medical care, whereupon law enforcement plays Russian roulette with them, urinates on them, doesn't give them any medical care. And that's actually one of the most important things because there was no plan for caring for these people. And when the National Guard tries to do triage and when doctors show up, they themselves are traumatized from this. They remain for the next 30 years traumatized by what they saw.
So shocking. I mean, what you're describing, obviously illegal. Was anyone held accountable? I mean, were there indictments?
No. The story of Attica continues because the state then decides that it really does have a mess on its hands, that there needs to be a public inquiry into Attica. There's indeed a few politicians begin inquiries into what had happened at Attica. But ultimately, the most important probably in terms of the fate of all of these guys is the state's own investigation. And the state's own investigation, I discovered, was in so many ways corrupt from the beginning because the state of New York, specifically the governor's office, had its people very close to the chest, made sure that it knew what was happening with the investigation, even though, of course, its own troopers could have been indicted, and began an investigation that ultimately only resulted in indicting prisoners for, quote unquote, crimes committed during the rebellion. Notably, they also allowed the same state police who had retaken the prison to investigate what had happened at the prison. So from the beginning, of course, we soon learn that there are, you know, photographs tampered with and missing and statements altered. And that is just the beginning of what will be a nightmare for the prisoners because ultimately 62 of them are indicted and what will be ultimately officers getting off scot-free.
You're saying there was a cover-up, a massive cover-up, and that has gone on for years, for decades.
Yes, they did. I mean, as bodies are showing up in the morgue, there's phalanxes of troopers going and standing there, their physical presence intimidating the coroner who's trying to determine the cause of death on the prisoners, and traveling to all these funeral homes where the hostage bodies went, and insisting to the funeral directors that these guys had not been shot, and intimidating them. In fact, intimidating one funeral director into signing an affidavit that the hostage had not died from gunshot wounds. So it was at the police level, there is no question that this was an active cover-up. At the gubernatorial level, you know, I also discovered that within a week of this retaking, the governor has meetings, secret meetings, a series of them at his pool house in his mansion in upstate New York.
This was Nelson Rockefeller.
Yeah, that's right, where he's got the state troopers, the head of the state troopers who had actually carried out the retaking there. He's got the attorney general in charge of the Attica investigation there. And, you know, and they all work to create a narrative, a chronology of what happened, which, of course, effectively meant getting their story straight.
Now, you have exposed all kinds of things about how this was handled, about a cover-up. Your book has been described as pro-prisoner, and it's gotten some criticism because of that. I mean that you sort of have one very strong point of view. What do you say to that criticism?
I think that's not a fair statement. I will absolutely own that it is pro-prisoner in the sense that I think this is a very important story for the nation to read because prisoners are, of course, all of us, right? They are our children. They are our fathers. They are our brothers. They are our sisters. They're human beings. So I feel like it is a pro-human story more than a pro-prisoner story.
Now, this whole bloody mess, the Attica prison uprising, started because of prisoner grievances about the conditions that they were forced to live in. What has happened to the way prisoners are treated, how they live at Attica today?
Well, this is, of course, the tragedy of the entire book, that we had one of the most historically remarkable protests inside of a prison to improve prison conditions. But the way that the state told Attica, the way that it said that this was all down to prisoner barbarity and that it was about the prisoner's violence, not the state's violence, that story would shape the next decades of prison policy and the backlash to prisoner rights and the backlash to the idea that prisoners are human beings was so severe that it is not accidental that after 1971 we began a prison buildup that resulted in us ultimately locking up more people than any other country on the planet and, frankly, in treating prisoners far worse today than we even did then. And so Attica becomes the emotional fuel that really drives this punitive impulse. The stories, the lies told about Attica become what fuels people into a frenzy and wants them to be so punitive that they will pass a three strikes law ultimately, and they will pass very draconian drug laws because they have been told that prisoners are animals and that they're not people and that given their druthers, they will slit your throat and castrate you. That fallout was immeasurable, I think. But there is another legacy, which is that Attica showed incredible unity and that people will always resist that. They will always stand together to resist that. And I think we're also seeing that now, that prisoners, they're people. And so therefore, there will always be a response to that level of repression.
Historian Heather Ann Thompson. She's the author of Blood in the Water, The Attica Prison Uprising of 1971 and Its Legacy. Steve Paulson talked with her. Most of us have no idea what life in prison is really like. It's off limits to the public and also mostly to the press. Shane Bauer is a criminal justice reporter who got frustrated when he tried to write a story about a private prison. And then he had a wild idea. Why not try to get a job there?
So I filled out an application online and within a couple weeks, I had several prisons to choose from.
Shane spent 4 months working as a guard in a private prison. He published an expose in Mother Jones magazine in which he details appalling conditions for everyone there, inmates and guards. His job was at Wynn Correctional Center, 3 hours north of Baton Rouge. And one of the strange things is why he was even hired in the first place. Because all it takes is one Google search to discover that Shane is not only a criminal justice reporter, he also has a personal reason for caring about prison conditions. He himself was captured and spent 26 months in an Iranian prison. Somehow, that never came up.
In my interviews, they didn't even ask me why I wanted to work in a prison. They didn't ask me anything about my job history. And I think it comes down to the fact that a lot of these prisons are very desperate for employees. You know, the job is very dangerous. The pay is very low. There's not many people that are willing to take these jobs. So when somebody applies, you know, the head of training told us in training that as long as you're breathing, you have a driver's license and a GED, and you're willing to work, then we're willing to hire you.
Wow. So this is just the beginning of the stuff that you heard and saw that to the uninitiated, you know, like me, seems absolutely shocking. When people told you stuff like this, did you have a hard time controlling your face or your expression?
Sometimes. I mean, I wouldn't generally comment on what people were saying. I would just kind of ask questions and listen. And, you know, you ask a lot of most people, you ask them questions and they're happy to talk.
What was the training like? I mean, would you say you were well trained to start the job?
There were 4 weeks of training. A lot of the training was, I think this is common in prisons where, you know, you're kind of being trained to not interact with prisoners like you would another person. Any kind of sign of, you know, friendliness or normal discussion is to be seen as manipulation. We were told many times that once we started the job, we would realize that we're not making enough money for the job and that we were going to be tempted, you know, to start smuggling in contraband. And I think everybody there recognized that a big part of the problem was that the guards were paid so little and had a hard time surviving. One of my first days of training, we were asked what we would do if we saw two inmates stabbing each other. And, you know, the instructor told us, we are not going to pay you enough to get in the middle of a fight. If these fools want to cut each other up, then happy cutting.
Whoa. Just for the inmates, how dangerous was this? You said you saw a bunch of stabbings. How badly did people get hurt?
It varied. There were times that a prisoner got stabbed more than 30 times. I later found after I left that in the first 4 months of 2015, around 200 weapons had been found in the prison, which is much, much higher than any other prison in Louisiana. You know, they could not rely on the staff to make them safe. There was even, when I was there, an escape. There was a man who had, in the middle of the day, jumped over two barbed wire fences. He was in view of the guard towers, but nobody saw him escape because there were no guards in the towers. The company had cut those positions, you know, to save money. And this is really what I saw over and over again, kind of corners being cut to save money. I mean, this company has to make a profit. And the main way to do that is to cut staff.
One of the worst places in the jail that you write about is the segregation unit. It was actually the first place you were posted. What were the conditions there like?
Prisoners would be mostly double-celled in a 7-by-11-foot cell, if I remember right. And a lot of the cells didn't have lights. Some of them didn't have running water. And there was a part of this unit that was reserved for suicidal prisoners. It was called Suicide Watch. So if an inmate said that he was suicidal, he would be put here. There were no mental health staff there. It was just a guard watching them. He would be in a cell alone in solitary confinement with no clothes, would have no mattress, no books, generally nothing to occupy his mind. And he was actually given worse food than the rest of the prison population, the caloric value of which fell below USDA standards. There was one social worker for the whole prison, and she told us that part of the reason for the conditions being that way was to encourage prisoners to get off Suicide Watch, to want to leave. There was one inmate who I actually watched on Suicide Watch named Damien Costley, who later, after I left the prison, committed suicide. And he had been going on hunger strikes for years, demanding better mental health support. And when he died, he weighed 71 pounds.
Oh, wow. How did the company maintain control? I mean, you must have seen conflicts break out, things that could have become riots.
There was what was called a SORT team, Special Operations Response Team, which is kind of a tactical team. They have pepper spray, and their job is to kind of subdue unrest.
Did you see prisoners gassed or chemical agents used?
I did see a man once in the segregation unit who had been doused in pepper spray. He was just kind of in a shower naked, screaming because his body was burning. But I'd never seen it outside of that. But I do know that when used pepper spray and tear gas at a rate that was 7 times higher than Angola prison, the maximum security prison in Louisiana. So it seemed that, especially in the segregation unit, that was a frequently used means of control.
You must have wound up feeling really sorry for the prisoners. I mean, they were there because they'd done terrible things, many of them. But did you wind up getting sympathetic, even friendly with some of them?
I did get friendly with some of the prisoners. But, you know, the dynamic was very complicated. I mean, when I first started, I really made an effort to treat everyone humanely. And I found that very difficult because ultimately I was doing a job where I had me and one other guy were managing 350 prisoners. And, you know, I learned very quickly that I had to, like everyone in the prison, whether they're prisoners or guards, I had to establish a line. And if anybody crossed that line, then I had to try to exert control. And everybody knew that at any moment, if they wanted to attack me, they could. And there's nothing I could do about it.
Now, you were there putting people in solitary confinement, guarding people on suicide watch. You're also someone who was himself detained in Iran.
Yep.
And you spent time in solitary yourself there, so you must have been able to relate to the prisoners. How did that play out for you? That must have put you in a pretty difficult bind.
It did. I mean, when I started there, my natural sympathy was with prisoners. But, you know, I was a guard, and I had to look out for myself, figure out, you know, how to deal with people that were threatening. And there were times that that involved sending people to the segregation unit. And when I made those choices, in a way, they were kind of spur of the moment choices that I was making because I was afraid. But afterwards, you know, I would really wrestle with this and really still do. I mean, knowing what it's like to be in solitary confinement, it's hard to justify putting someone there. But when you're there as a guard and that's the only option that the system provides, then you do what you have to do.
What was the hardest thing for you about all of this? What did you hate most?
I think the thing that I hated most was just seeing myself change and not really being able to be myself. You know, I saw myself quickly becoming authoritarian, and I saw a split happening in myself where I was one person on the job and one person when I got home. And this is something you hear commonly from guards, is that they feel they live two lives. And you know, I just felt towards the end that there, I was just so tense and kind of obsessed sometimes with all of the little conflicts that would happen with certain people and how I would try to manage them every day, that I just felt like I was kind of losing myself in a way.
Well, it's quite a sobering story. I imagine it stayed with you.
Yeah, it was a very intense and harrowing experience in many ways, and certainly not one that I'm going to forget.
Investigative journalist Shane Bauer spent 4 months working as a guard in a private prison.
He wrote about it for Mother Jones magazine. You can find a link to his report on our website at ttbook.org. And coming up, an English professor tours prisons in 9 different countries and brings home some unusual ideas. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. We're talking about prison reform in this hour, and here's an idea you won't hear anywhere else from philosopher Jason Brennan.
While caning is inhumane, it's superior to incarceration. So when we think about, say, Singapore, where people are punished by caning, that looks horrible to us. We think how barbaric that anyone would ever cane someone. It seems like a backwards way of doing things. And it is true that it's barbaric, and it is true that it's inhumane, but is it worse than incarceration? That's a real hard question to ask. So imagine a world in which everyone was caned. After you were caught doing something wrong, you were immediately given a short physical punishment and then you were set on your way. And then suppose you told that world about what we do in the United States, where even for relatively petty crimes, we lock you up in a jail for a long period of time. You get bad food. You have no freedom. You're likely to be subject to sexual abuse from your fellow prisoners while the guards look sideways. The guards themselves are likely to sexually abuse you and mistreat you. And then after that happens, when you finally get out, you've lost all these years of lives spending time rotting away in a jail cell, and you can't even get a job because you've been incarcerated in the past and people look at you as someone untrustworthy. I think in that world where everyone did caning instead, they would look at what we do and think, well, that's even more barbaric. I mean, we're just physically hurting people and you're depriving them of freedom and security for a long period of time. So right now we have a very high percent of Americans are in jail. I forget the exact number, but it's roughly a quarter of the world's prison population, despite having only 5% of the total population. And we keep people in jail for extremely long periods of time compared to other countries. So in some countries, a crime that might get you in jail for 3 years will keep you for 20 years, and a crime that will keep you for 25 years will keep you for life. So is this actually working to deter people from crime? Empirically, it doesn't look like it works. Empirically, it seems that deterrence works best if people are quickly caught and quickly punished and then set free. I mean, being punished right away is the thing that really matters when it comes to deterring crime rather than the length of the sentence.
Philosopher Jason Brennan. So that's one idea for criminal justice reform, in this case inspired by Singapore. Maybe other countries could offer some other ideas. Boz Dreisinger is an English professor. She's also a prison educator and restorative justice facilitator. And she recently set off on a 2-year pilgrimage to study prisons in 9 different countries. She writes about what she saw in a book called Incarceration Nations. And she sat down with Raymond Tangekar to talk about Norway's unusual approach to justice.
I visited 2 prisons in Norway that are by no means necessarily the norm. I went to Halden Prison, which is a traditional prison in that it has a wall and it's
been called the nicest prison in the world, I've heard.
It has, yep. But the people there are confined there, and it is quite amazing. There is a music studio, cooking classes, painting classes, agriculture. The dorms where people live look like apartments. It's quite beautiful. But the philosophy there is if we have the money and the resources to be able to build prisons like this that genuinely rehabilitate people and genuinely engage in this process of corrections, why shouldn't we do it? The notion there is that loss of liberty is what a prison sentence is about. It's not about torturing you with bad conditions. On the contrary, it's about giving you sustenance, healing, and addressing the sort of cause that got you to prison in the first place. So Halden is Norway's statement in a way, because there are lots of prisons in Norway that don't look remotely like Halden. But Halden is a statement to say we are committed to treating our prisoners like human beings. They may lose their liberty, but they're still worthy of being treated like human beings and worthy of facing rehabilitation.
Hmm. Well, I understand you visited two kinds of prisons in Norway. What's the other one?
Yeah, there are two models related to the two prisons that I visited. So Halden is the more traditional one, exceptional in its conditions, exceptional in its programming. The incarcerated individuals there are in some kind of program at all times. They're taking classes. They're relating to, and this I think is really, really important, the corrections staff in Norway comes from a background of social work, philosophy, law, not military corrections and not criminal justice. And so they're really trying to work with them. They use first name. They address each other on a first name basis. And they kept emphasizing this to me, relations. Relations is so important. So everything at Halden is about may look, have sort of the trappings of being a traditional prison, a wall and so on. But it's all about doing it in an extraordinarily humane way with an emphasis on this idea of relations. And then the other prison that I went to is a very famous one in Norway called Bastøy, and it's an open prison. And open prisons allow the incarcerated to come and go, work jobs on the outside, and have family leave time for weekends.
Wait, they can just leave the prison?
Yeah. They work jobs on the outside, and they come back at night.
Huh. Does it work?
It absolutely works. They have the failure to return rate, as it's called, is something like 1%. So people come back. And Bastøy is very exceptional also in that it's run like it's an ecological retreat in a sense. It's on an island. It's extraordinarily beautiful. And there's organic farming. There are horses. And the incarcerated men there live in kind of log cabins with cooking pits. So it's run as almost like a commune in a sense. And everyone there is permitted to go home for weekend leave. They have regular visits. All of them work jobs. There's a ferry over, and the ferry is manned by two men who are incarcerated on Bastøy. So it's sort of work release on steroids because it's really open. And it's very much about thinking reintegration from the moment someone is incarcerated. And again, the philosophy is you have lost your liberty, but you have not lost your rights.
Huh. Is there pushback in Norway against this concept?
There is starting to be a bit of pushback, and I certainly think the Breivik case, the case of the neo-Nazi who slaughtered all those people and is locked up in a prison in Norway and taking college classes, there's starting to be some backlash. But for the most part, the Norwegians accept this as a very effective and humane approach. The crime rate is very low. And the recidivism rate is very low. Norway has one of the lowest recidivism rates in the world. So I think there's an attitude of, well, if it's working, should we really mess with it?
I mean, I imagine a cynic would hear that your description of the two models and say, if you're treating inmates this well, it doesn't give them an incentive to reform or change in any significant way. But it sounds like you're saying that's not true at all.
I mean, I find that such a ludicrous argument. Who wants to lose their liberty? It's the most precious commodity. We live it every day. I was in Bastøy and Halden, and I spoke with many people, and the loneliness is intense. It's the same loneliness there that I saw in some of the more traditionally awful prisons. So I think it really comes down to thinking about the philosophy of what we are doing. Are we punishing people or are we correcting people? Are we engaging in justice or are we engaging in revenge? And I don't find, and I talk about this quite a bit in the book, especially in the Rwanda and South Africa chapters, but I have a problem with revenge. I have a problem with punishment. I don't find it moral. I think you can correct someone. I think that I certainly believe in restitution and reparations and making amends for your harm and the victim's needs being met. But I don't see a system of justice being about how can we harm someone? How can we take revenge on someone? How do we tell them you did something bad by doing something bad to them? So Norway is an inspiration in that way.
So reflecting on this whole experience, are there similarities among criminal justice systems that you think work?
Well, I mean, I could start actually with what doesn't work. Overall, I can say that prisons as an exclusive response to crime do not work. They're not humane. They don't reduce recidivism rates. They don't deter people from committing crime. And they certainly don't correct people. They turn people even more dysfunctional than they may have been when they came in. And I saw this really across the board. So to flip that, what does work are scenarios where people's humanity is given a chance to manifest itself. And that generally happens when people remain integrated with communities, as in the case of work release, family release, and in scenarios that involve restorative justice, scenarios where people are given the opportunity to actually make restitution for their harm, to take ownership and responsibility for both the ways that they have harmed others and have been harmed by systems, by people, by poverty, by racism, and so on. So for me, the future of justice is really about a restorative approach, and it's about replacing revenge with restitution and reparations on a grand scale.
Baz Dreisinger is an English professor and the founder of the Prison to College Pipeline. She's the author of Incarceration Nations, A Journey to Justice in Prisons Around the World. Raymond Tungekar talked with her. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. And now it's time for A Dangerous Idea.
My name is Brian Stevenson. I'm a human rights lawyer in Montgomery, Alabama. I direct a project called the Equal Justice Initiative. And my dangerous idea is about how to overcome mass imprisonment and excessive punishment in America. Our prison population has gone from 300,000 in 1972 to 2.3 million today. We've got 6 million people on probation and parole, 68 million Americans with criminal arrests. I think that we could radicalize our commitment to helping people recover from the mistakes they make if we began to incentivize our vast infrastructure of jails and prisons to actually pick up the challenge of rehabilitation, of restoration, of recovery. What I'd like to do is to create financial prizes for the prisons that release people who have the lowest recidivism rate. I'd like to reward correctional employees who find ways to inspire and educate and empower the people who are in prison and incarcerated under their supervision to leave prison and never come back. I think you'd see a very different prison system emerge. You wouldn't have the indifference to what happens. You wouldn't tolerate the abuse and misjudgments and mistreatment. You'd actually have people pulling together to find ways to help people stay free from drugs and alcohol dependency, stay free from the violence and the environments that create despair and suffering. And I think it would radicalize our criminal justice system. But more than that, I think it would revolutionize our society. There are too many people living hopelessly. And I think we ought to be creating the incentives, and I don't have a problem making them financial incentives, to turn the prison industrial complex into something that's more like the redemption industrial complex, where we actually invest in changing lives rather than throwing lives away. I think we've just abandoned rehabilitation in ways that have left us really vulnerable. And we now see this revolving door where lots of communities are just being fractured by the way in which there is no stability or security or public safety. And so, yes, I think we need to reorient ourselves to a new concept of justice that really is rooted in helping people recover.
Civil rights lawyer Brian Stevenson with his dangerous idea. And you can hear more dangerous ideas on our website at ttbook.org. Throughout this hour, we've been talking about humane prisons, and for the most part, the suggestions have been pretty practical. But there's a deeper way to think about justice. Martha Nussbaum is one of the most famous living philosophers, and part of her work involves coming up with new ways to think about social justice and reform. In her latest book, Anger and Forgiveness, she explores the corrosive effect that anger plays in personal relationships, politics, and also in criminal justice systems. She tells Steve Paulson that retribution and payback are not the path to true justice.
In life, it's very easy to believe that if you pay somebody back, that actually improves the situation or balances out the wrong. You know, if your child has been killed, you want to kill the person who did that. But we really have to ask, does that do any good? And actually, proportional wrong for wrong, pain for pain, doesn't in and of itself actually help to restore the thing that was lost.
But is there any case to be made for payback?
Well, I think there's just one situation in which payback actually gets you the thing that you want, and that is where you're seeing the insult as entirely about relative status. I think that, you know, society is full of that, and we really do get angry a lot. But that itself is a very narrow and unfortunate scheme of values. So much better when there is a wrongful damage and we are pained about it and we want to do something about it, to then turn to the future and say, what really shall we do?
What about the idea that payback actually serves some other uses as well? It gives victims and their families a sense of closure, for instance. Is that hold any water for you?
Well, you know, people can learn to take pleasure in all kinds of sadistic activities. So, you know, to me, if the thing is wrong, the fact that lots of people take pleasure in it doesn't really cut any ice, because those preferences are learned and they can be unlearned. People also used to derive a lot of pleasure from raping women and subordinating them.
But so is that really what we're talking about? We're talking about something really bad happened to me. And,
well,
you know, I want to see.
Closure is a fiction. Closure is a fiction. We can trace its history. It was a movement. There's a victim rights movement that started about 20 years ago. And when the critics of victim impact statements in criminal trials first were writing articles about why victim impact statements pervert the equal application of justice, there were very few people asking about closure. And by now, that movement has been very successful, and it's persuaded a lot of people that they'll never get closure unless they stand up in court and appeal for a higher sentence. But, you know, you can trace the history of it, and you can see that it's a social fad, and not every fad should be gratified.
Well, let's take a case that's been in the news recently, the Stanford rape case, where there was outrage over the very light sentence, only 6 months in a county jail, that Brock Turner got after he was convicted of a brutal sexual assault. And the common response was intense anger. He got off way too easily. Justice was not served. And we've got to let everyone know about it so this kind of thing won't happen again.
Yeah, I agree with the outrage. But I think the reason is that this kind of crime is highly deterrable. Now, with athletes, and I actually have had a painful experience in my own history with a famous actor. With famous actors and athletes, they are the last two groups of people in our culture who think they're above the law. They don't have to obey the normal rules. So the reason that it would have been good for him to get a heavier sentence is to put him and all other such people on notice that they're not above the law. But it's not because of retribution we do that. It's because of the future, which we can, of course, change. And it's the only thing that we can change.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned that you yourself had a painful personal experience. What happened?
Yeah, well, I wrote about it on the Huffington Post, so you can get all the details there if you want to. But when I was about 20 years old, I started to date a well-known actor and was sexually assaulted by that actor. And in those days, it was just not going to be possible to go to the police. I record in the piece that later he ran for an important political office. And at that point, which was 20 years after the event, I did think of coming forward because I thought, how outrageous. And I wanted to prevent that person from holding an office of public trust. But what everyone said to me is, you know, he's going to say you're extorting money. He's going to say you're just trying to capitalize on his fame. So, you know, I just didn't do it. But I was happy to note that in obituaries for the guy, there were at least some newspapers, mostly outside the United States, that did mention his bad behavior.
So, I mean, so this was a case where you were angry. Maybe not because
I think I was really, my emotion was what I call transition anger. That is, I thought it was outrageous that he should hold political office, and I wanted to prevent that from happening.
Why not just call that anger?
Because I didn't want payback. I actually hadn't thought of this guy from that day to this. I was not upset. Now, let me just back up one step and say that if we're thinking about crime generally, and if you have the forward-looking attitude that I recommend that says these things are outrageous, you will actually start way further back. You'll think, how do I bring up young people who are not even inclined to create a world where those kinds of crimes skate scot-free? So if we think about the Stanford rapist, sure, yeah, I mean, specific and general deterrence are served by giving him a prison term. But much more important is, how can we bring up athletes and other young people who do not see themselves as able to use the bodies of women as toys? So that's where we should be focusing our energy. And with crime in general, we should be focusing on things like housing, employment, educational opportunities. You know, those are the things that really bring about less crime in society. Once the crime has occurred, it's in a way too late.
It sounds like you're saying that we really need to reform our criminal justice system, which is very much about retribution and about punishment. Are you saying we should, for the most part, get rid of that whole element of punishment?
Well, I am saying that part of our system is retributive and part is inspired by theories of deterrence and reform. It's a real mixture. And that mixture has been around for thousands of years. So it's an old debate, but I think we should drop the retributive part. And what that means is, first of all, backing up and thinking about criminals as not born bad, as people who would probably much prefer not to steal. But if they are brought up correctly with educational opportunities, with nutrition and so on. So that is a very large social task. We don't really understand how to do it. We have many theories. And so because we despair of succeeding in bringing up people who are not going to be criminals, we fall back on this payback idea. And I think that's really, really unfortunate.
But what happens if they do then commit a crime?
Well, if they do commit a crime, then we have to ask, what do we do? Now, as I say, we have a number of legitimate interests. One of them is accountability. We have to make a statement that this is a bad thing so that other people will understand that and they won't do it. So that's general deterrence. And we also have to make a statement to that individual so that individual won't do it. We would hope we might even be able to reform that individual. And so we have to ask, given the type of crime it is, how to balance out those interests? What do we do? And I think there will be other cases where we might use imprisonment, but I think not as many as we do. I mean, think about sexual harassment. Nobody goes to jail for sexual harassment, but they often lose their job. They often have their company have to pay a hefty fine if the company is found to be liable. So those things have proven very successful.
Now, we've been talking about the powerful emotion of anger, and there's another one, a very different kind of emotion you also write about, forgiveness. And I think, you know, there's sort of this common sort of feeling that, oh, forgiveness is kind of a wimpy thing. It's sort of a weak emotion, but that's not the way you say it, do you?
Well, actually, I think we have to, first of all, distinguish different kinds of forgiveness. And the sort of canonical kind of forgiveness is what I call transactional forgiveness. That is, I will waive my angry feelings toward you if you grovel before me, you confess your wrongdoing, say you won't do it again, and so on. It really is a kind of covert form of anger. I'm going to keep punishing you with my anger until you sufficiently humble yourself before me. Now, then we move to what is often emphasized by Jesus in the Gospels, and that's unconditional forgiveness. And we see this in this wonderful response of the people in South Carolina to Dylann Roof's murders.
Oh, it's absolutely astonishing. I mean, the relatives of those 9 people who were murdered, I mean, their response immediately to Dylann Roof was, "I forgive you."
And, you know, even more interesting was the one woman who says, "I still feel really angry, but I know that I'm a work in progress." So that church had given them the sense that this is work. You have to do work on your feelings. And they had been doing that. And I'm amazed at that. I think they were great. So that's unconditional forgiveness. You start with anger and then you waive it unconditionally. And of course, I think that's vastly superior. Even better, I think, is not to get into the morass of anger in the first place, but maybe just to start out with a generous spirit. Nelson Mandela learned that the best way to approach people who had wronged him was to think, how shall I treat them in order to build cooperation and friendship? The love comes first, and that's the way that Mandela always treated people, that there was a kind of open-hearted generosity that came first, and then his advice to them about what the nation should be like and how it should change came afterwards. So that's what I really like best, and I think it's better in personal relations, but also in political relationships.
Philosopher Martha Nussbaum. She's the author of Anger and Forgiveness, and she was talking with Steve Paulson. That's it for this hour, but there's always more in our podcast feed. Plus, every week we send out a newsletter. It's full of notes about what we've been reading and thinking about, and it's a fun way to get behind the scenes. You can sign up at ttbook.org/newsletter. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio by Charles Monroe Kane, Mark Rickers, Shannon Henry Kleiber, and Halima Shah. Our sound designer and technical director is Joe Hartke. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson, and I'm Ann Strangchamps. Thanks for listening.